Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for an hour of lots of science in the news today, science and research and some promising things, as well as usual, your questions, emails, and calls. So I hope that you will stay tuned for the next hour. But before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It's not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Wanted to start with big news all over the newspapers and press the last 24 hours or so, and that's the human embryonic stem cell study in spinal injury that has just been approved. This is a human study. It's all been done in rats. Now we're actually going to try to do it in humans. The company is Geron, and what they'll be doing is trying to grow back the myelin sheath of spinal columns in people who have recent, I want to emphasize, recent as in the last 2 weeks, spinal injuries that have caused paralysis. It's kind of a bizarre lottery. And if you happen to know someone who has a spinal transection in the next 2 weeks, I expect that they will be contacted by their physician if they happen to go to one of the 7 centers that are selected for this study. It's a pilot study looking for evidence of harm. In some of the older studies, the stem cells formed these little round cysts. Didn't seem to hurt the rats, but we really can't query a rat about strange sensations or other oddities. Now that we're doing it in people, we will find out if indeed those cysts form, and if so, if they're a problem. When a nerve, a peripheral nerve, is cut, the insulating layer is also cut. Now, the nerve cell itself is like a giant octopus, really, if you want to think about it that way. There's a cell body back in the spinal column, and the nerve is a tentacle from that octopus. What happens to an octopus when you cut off a tentacle? Well, it draws back the tentacle, but the octopus doesn't die. In the case of nerve cells, they resprout and try to grow back. But the problem is they don't have a pathway to grow. The myelin sheath, which is formed by other cells called Schwann cells, forms a tube of fat, and the nerve was running along the inside of that tube. When the nerve cell resprouts from the root and tries to regrow, it doesn't find the myelin tube. The tube's been disrupted because of the transection, and so there's no clear tunnel to grow through. Sometimes the nerve or part of the nerve is successful in growing across that gap. But what this stem cell work will do is not regrow the neuron, but rather create a new myelin sheath that will allow that tube to reform. So it's important to understand this isn't the same as regrowing the neuron. This is a myelin growing project, but it will make a big difference in spinal cord injuries. And it's an important thing to be creating. We're very happy to see this work finally starting out in humans. And it's just one of a number of very exciting things that have shown up this week. I wanted to reply to something that one of our callers last week, Susan in Monterey, had talked about, and that was a question about regenerating adult peripheral axons. Now, this is more getting the nerve cell to grow, so it dovetails very, very nicely with this Geron myelin research that's going to be starting. This is research done in rats who have had a peripheral nerve injury, and the researchers are trying to facilitate regeneration of the damaged nerve cell, the axon of the neuron. That's a very, very different thing. What they have found is that there is a protein called phosphoinositide 3 kinase, and it's a signal that turns on DNA in the nerve that allows the axon to grow. The researchers have been looking at something called PTEN, which is a deletion of this protein signal. And what they found is that this signal actually is turning down nerve regeneration. So if they can reduce the PTEN, P-T-E-N, then they get more nerve growth. They're turning off the messenger RNA, I should say, using this small RNA, microRNA that has been researched. So the idea is if you have the messenger RNA floating around in the cell, it's supposed to go off to the ribosome and be translated into a protein. If you take that messenger RNA and bond it like a zipper to a microRNA, you've inactivated it and the protein can't be made. The protein can't be made. It can't go back to the nucleus and inhibit the cell growth. So the cell grows more readily. This is working in rats to increase healing from severe nerve transection injuries. But it's in rats. So it'll be a while before we see this in humans. And a real significant downside risk anytime you turn off a brake on growth is that you may not be able to turn off uncontrolled growth. And if there are cancers present or precancers present, there is at least theoretically a possibility that you could, well, benefit the growth of those cancers. So this sort of work needs to be worked out very carefully and very clearly. Last thing in the world we want to do is take a healthy person, otherwise healthy, with a spinal cord transection, make them walk and give them brain cancer. That would be the most horrendous good news, bad news result of too rapid or too accelerated research. It's frustrating if you're a person with the injury, but we have to go slowly. We just have to. Two news stories this week about Parkinson's disease, one of them also relating to microRNAs. This research was just published in the journal Nature, and some of the major researchers were at Stanford. It shows that Parkinson's disease can be affected by microRNAs. There's a malfunction in them leading to an overproduction of proteins that lead to brain cell death. They found that in people who are developing Parkinson's disease, levels of overproduced proteins, and they found a way of decreasing those with a microRNA. In doing that, they were able to prevent the death of the cells making dopamine. Now, the interesting thing about this in connection with the next story is that if we can find a way to produce and clone these microRNAs and turn off the overproduction, we may be able to prevent the development of Parkinson's disease in its early stages. Well, that's great, except how do you identify early stage Parkinson's disease? And that brings us to this next study, which is a study coming out of sleep centers. This was recently published, and it shows that there is a kind of sleep disorder that's known as rapid eye movement sleep behavior disorder that over a long period of time predicts the development of Parkinson's disease, multiple system atrophy, and Lewy body dementia. So if we can identify people who have a disorder that is a marker for Parkinson's disease in the future, we may be able to treat them with very small doses of agents that block cell death. It's all very preliminary and theoretical, but it's all very interesting. This REM sleep behavior disorder is an interesting bug too. When it occurs, people lose sleep paralysis during their dream sleep. So they will jump up and maybe punch or run or try to get away. It's a known sleep disorder that has not been linked to any long-term degenerative disease before this story. What this suggests, and of course we don't know really what the absolute rate of progression is, this is a very small study, only 27 people, but it is important in that it may serve as a marker for Parkinson's disease, and it's possible that we may be able, just on doing screening sleep studies on people, particularly if they have a family history, to look into their DNA, identify this malfunction that I was talking about with the overproduction of protein, and possibly block this disease development in its very early preclinical stages. I also find it very intrinsically interesting because the fact that when you are dreaming, your body is completely paralyzed implicates the movement centers of the brain, which is, of course, where Parkinson's disease takes hold. And it shows that an early malfunction of the movement center is an inability to inhibit movement during sleep. In other words, a loss of the normal sleep paralysis. Ironically, as this disease progresses, the movement center eventually becomes unable to facilitate movement. And so an absence of paralysis in the early stages becomes effectively a presence of excess paralysis in the late stages of the disease of the same organ. Sort of ironic and interesting, and maybe a little theoretical. So let's get down to something a bit more practical. And let's go now to Susan in Santa Cruz. Hello, Susan, and welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. Yes, I'm calling. I have an illness that I'm having a really hard time getting diagnosed. My symptoms are that they've been getting worse. It's been going on for about 6 months. Symptoms are they really have an overall feeling of unwellness, like a flu-like nausea and weakness. And I get pain in my bladder area and kind of like symptoms of UTI, but there's no infection there. And then it will move into my bowel area. And
What do you mean move into your bowel? Do you get diarrhea?
I get diarrhea and constipation. It just kind of goes back and forth. I've had an ultrasound. I'm awaiting results for colonoscopy. I've had blood tests, OVA parasite tests, the A125 test.
Everything. How old are you?
I'm 55.
So it's malaise, just feeling unwell. Are there a lot of body aches or joint pains?
No joint or body aches.
No body aches.
No fever. Started, I was living in Mexico 6 months ago, and I started having pain and was diagnosed with a kidney infection. And I took antibiotics for that. It went away, and I kind of had UTI symptoms return. I ended up taking about 3 rounds of antibiotics. And then when I came back to the States, a urine culture revealed that there was no infection. So I thought that maybe it was interstitial cystitis or something, but it's just gotten worse to the point that I'm debilitated. I can't go out. I can't do anything.
Okay, so something happened while you were in Mexico, and it got diagnosed as a bladder infection. I'm going to just riff on bladder infections a little bit in that I do a lot of a secondary test that isn't typically done, should be done, in my opinion, which is I spin the urine and look at it with a microscope. About half the time when I do that, I find out that the positive dipstick that I've gotten is because there's vaginal fluid in the urine at the time that you put the stick, the paper. It's just basically kind of like pH paper, but they're papers that turn positive if there's nitrogen or turn positive if there's leukocytes. The problem is you have nitrogen and leukocytes and bacteria in your vagina all the time, and any vaginal fluid that gets into the urine, which is easy to have happen, will give you a false positive and lead to inappropriate antibiotic therapy. I don't know about the kidney infection. I mean, you may very well have had pyelonephritis, but when you take 3 courses of antibiotics, you're bound to have messed up your bowel flora. So at the very minimum, you've probably disrupted your GI tract and your bowel flora. Now, ordinarily, I wouldn't anticipate that that would cause persistent urethral symptoms or bladder symptoms. So what I'm thinking is that it's aggravated some sort of other condition that was present that was not bad enough to, you know, it was under the radar, so to speak, and now it's no longer under the radar. So one possibility would be that you've got some food sensitivities that now that you've disrupted your flora, you're getting, let's say, more food antigens that you have antibodies to, and the antibodies are forming complexes, and those are irritating the bladder and overloading your reticuloendothelial system, which is your spleen and your lymph nodes, which have to take these antibody complexes out of the bloodstream. If you want to look this up in a Western medicine textbook, you want to look up serum sickness. We used to see this clinical entity back when we used horse serum for vaccinations, and we didn't have other ways of vaccinating for certain things. So we would put the germs into horses, and then we'd use horse antibody, but people who had eaten horse meat would have antibodies against horse protein, and they would react to the horse serum. And it's an old, old disease that everybody's forgotten about. And I think it's resurging. At least let me put it this way. Purely anecdotal. From my standpoint, it's anecdotal. I heard about this entity 5-10 years ago when I started studying functional medicine. Thought, that's interesting. I wonder if it's true. Started treating patients with checking what foods they were sensitive to and then having them not eat them. And all of these weird, vague symptoms went away. And so if it's a placebo, it's a damn effective one, and I'm happy enough because I fixed the patient. So you might want to consider getting food antibody testing or going on an elimination diet.
Okay, well...
And you can email me. Go to the website, askdrdon.com.
Mm-hmm.
Just use the Contact Us tab, and I will send you an elimination diet, which you should do for about 3 or 4 weeks,
okay. And
then reassess your symptoms.
Right.
If your symptoms have all gotten better, then great, woohoo, call me back, and I'll tell you how to figure out how to go back on foods gradually and figure out what's causing it, so then you know what to avoid.
Okay.
In the meantime, high doses of probiotics, 25 to 30 billion mixed organisms a day, and there are very good probiotics out there, but you just need to make sure that you've got the dose high enough.
Right.
There's an excellent interview on the website with a guy named Hufnagel, and you can go to the archives on the Ask Dr. Don website and read about that and listen to that one, excuse me,
okay. And
that will give you information about probiotics and dosing.
Well, I have eliminated a lot from my diet. I've been working with a nutritionist. I've eliminated everything, you know.
No, you haven't. Not everything.
Okay. So the other thing.
Yeah.
Can I ask a question? The ova and parasite test that I had revealed an Indolagmax nana, which is, I guess, not necessarily a pathogen. But
you know, you cheated.
What?
You withheld information.
Oh, but I'm sorry. Well, I wanted to get to that.
Okay, go ahead.
Anyways, I did around a lot of herbal treatment for it, which didn't work. So I did go on Flagyl, and that was about 2 weeks ago. And the symptoms are still there. And my sense is that it could be a parasite if Flagyl wasn't addressing, and that I don't know. Because nobody can seem to make the connection between the way that it affects my bladder as well as the rest of, you know, the nausea, everything.
Well, I just did make a suggestion, and that's because these antibody complexes are in the bloodstream, so they will affect the bladder as well as the bowel.
Yeah.
You know, that particular bacteria is, if you look it up in the textbooks, they say it's not a human pathogen.
Yeah.
If you think about what a parasite does, even if it's not going to make you very sick, it is going to disrupt the barrier function of the colon and the intestine. And if your barrier function isn't good, and you have...
So barrier function?
Barrier, as in it is a barrier.
Oh, okay, yeah.
If the proteins don't stay in the intestine and the immune system's exposed to them, then you get these antibody complexes forming. And then that kicks the whole thing off. Once you fix the parasite, guess what? Yeah. You've still got the antibody complexes. You've still got the epithelial damage. You still have to repair it. So you're expecting that the parasite is causing the disease. Actually, the parasite just set it up. And now it has a life of its own. So you could even eliminate the parasite successfully and still end up with the residual issues.
And does that last for a while?
You have to heal the intestine and get your barrier function back, and you have to avoid any foods you're sensitive to.
Okay.
So I'm still going to stand by getting tested.
Getting tested for parasites?
No, getting tested for food antibodies.
Food antibodies. And what kind of test is that?
It's called IgG, not IgE. And if you go to an allergist, I guarantee he'll order the wrong test.
IgE.
Is the wrong test.
Okay.
IgG is the right test.
Okay. Do I get that through my regular doctor?
I don't know. Depends on how open-minded your regular doctor is and whether they're willing to take this advice or whether they call up the allergist and get told this is nonsense. Good luck. Anyway, if you want to refer them to me for further information, I'll be happy to give it to them. I'm a regular MD. I do this stuff in a regular clinical practice because it works. Okay.
Okay, so you're saying, so I just want to summarize, you're saying that it could be the antibodies, the parasites that were possibly there.
No, I'm not saying that.
I mean,
I'm going to restate it one more time, and then I'm going to have to go to another call.
All right, that's fine.
All right. Step one, you get an infection. Step two, you take antibiotics.
Yeah.
Step three, that messes up your bowel flora.
Right.
With or without the parasite. But the parasite also interferes with the barrier function. So messed up bowel flora, in other words, bad bacteria, no good bacteria, parasite, plus or minus. Now you don't have good barrier function. You have a leaky gut. Now the proteins from the food get into the immune system. The immune system grabs the proteins from the food. We're no longer caring about the parasites or the bacteria. That antibody antigen complex goes everywhere, makes you feel sick, gives you your interstitial cystitis, messes with your gut. All right. Now we take away the parasite. We restore the flora. We've still got a problem with barrier functioning. It's still broken. You have to restore the barrier functioning. That is beyond the scope of this discussion.
Okay.
But it can be done. In the meantime, avoidance of things that are making you sick will improve your symptoms.
Okay.
So you need to figure out what those are, which is where the food antibody testing comes in handy.
Okay.
Okay?
All And is the IgG test, is that a blood test?
Yes.
Okay.
Good luck.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Bye. And just to that last caller, if you run into problems, you can always call me. I'm up here in Santa Cruz. You can come in for a consultation, or you can just arrange for further assistance by phone. It can happen even at a distance. So let's take a big, deep breath. And before we go to our next caller, I have more stem cells to tell you about. This one is a real holy grail, and that's fixing joints, regrowing cartilage. Oh, yes, please, let's not have to do joint replacements. This just is published in the online version of The Lancet. And what these researchers did was they took rabbits, and I want to emphasize this is rabbits, and they used a CAD program, computer-aided design, to create a bone and protein scaffolding. If you want, they drew a wire diagram in a CAD program of what the joint is supposed to look like, what the cartilage is supposed to look like. Then they built it. Then they removed half the joints in a rabbit and put their little scaffolding in and closed up the rabbit. Now, what the scaffolding did was it actually summoned stem cells from the rabbit's own bone marrow. And those stem cells inhabited the scaffolding and they turned into chondrocytes, which are the cells that make cartilage, and they made cartilage. And they were able to show that these bioscaffolds actually did summon stem cells and that they did get organized cartilage regrowth. After about 4 months, they actually took the joints out and looked at them. And what they found was that the animals that got this bioscaffolding with a growth factor, a cloned chondrocyte growth factor, had full weight bearing and locomotion within 4 weeks of surgery. And when they looked at the joints, they had completely covered their implants with hyaline cartilage, and there was no cartilage formation in the animals that got only the scaffolding without the growth factor. So the growth factor made a huge difference, and there was absolutely no cartilage in animals who didn't get the implant. They got spontaneous migration of stem cells that were pre-existing by simply including a growth factor in an artificial bone and polyester matrix and using that to essentially, I'm thinking about the road work that's being done off of my exit right now on the highway. And first, when you want to build a new off-ramp, first you bulldoze the territory and create the template and then call in the resurfacing cells. If you don't have the template, the resurfacing cells just dump the asphalt and it doesn't go anywhere. So maybe a strained metaphor, but nevertheless, I think you get the idea. This is something that could be rolled out very rapidly, I would say 5 to 10 years. And I know we've been saying cartilage regrowth 5 to 10 years, but I find this an extremely promising bit of research. So I'm excited. Let's go to Doug in Santa Cruz. Hello, Doug, and welcome to the program.
Thank you for taking my call, Dr. Dawn.
You're welcome.
That'd be really nice if that works out on that cartilage thing. I don't know whether it would work for me. My metatarsal was crushed on my first toe there.
I think you'd be a good candidate for it. I mean, just in general.
It's already fused.
Oh, well, then forget it.
Maybe something else will come along.
Right.
My question was about my skin and my hair is very dry. And tried a number of, lotions on the outside externally to try and improve it. And internally, I do, probiotics twice a day. I do enzymes with all my foods. And I do all kinds of, omega 3, 6, and 9. And I eat a healthy diet. And I'm fairly healthy. I exercise regularly.
You have any gallbladder trouble?
I don't know.
Well, no history? You haven't had your gallbladder removed or anything?
No.
Okay. The reason I asked that was, with dry skin and dry hair, the first thing you think about is fatty acid insufficiency, and you say you're taking those, but maybe you're not absorbing them. So pancreatic
insufficiency. But I'm not absorbing the fats anymore.
That's possible.
Why?
Well, you may not be making enough pancreatic juice. The pancreas produces these enzymes that break down the fatty acids so that they can be reabsorbed. They have to form these little bubbles called micelles. And then they diffuse across the intestinal membrane. They're taken up by the villi. So it could be fat malabsorption. That's just a hypothesis. There's lots of other possibilities. But you can test that one by getting fatty acids analyzed. So you could get a blood test that looked at your omega-3 and your omega-6 and your omega-9 and made sure that you have high levels of them. That would be something you could get.
So in other words, to see whether or not it's just passing through.
Bingo. Yeah. It's a blood test to measure blood levels, because that's what's going to go to the skin, not your intestinal level, but your blood level.
Measure your omegas.
Right. And so that's a test. Genova Labs has that test. Your doctor can order it. That would be one thing. This isn't seborrhea, right? You don't have, like, thick scale?
I have a little bit of thick scale on one of my knuckles on my left hand.
But that's it?
Yeah.
Okay. Because, you know, seborrhea and psoriasis, variant forms of either one of those, sometimes people misdiagnose those and say, oh, I've got dry skin, because they've got flakes and scale.
Yeah.
And they might have actually skin that's overproducing cells, like
right.
Psoriasis.
Well, I went to a dermatologist, and he did not diagnose it as dermatitis.
Good.
Any of those things.
Good. Well, I'm glad that you've seen a dermatologist, because that is an issue. So it could be that you just don't have good oil production and you're going to have to apply externally. And there are some very good oils out there. Squalene, S-Q-A-L-E-N-E, is a very good one. It resembles human sebum very, very closely. So it's a really excellent replacement.
Something like aloe, huh?
No, aloe is really not going to do much. It's not an oil. It kind of creates a kind of cross-linked barrier. It's good for burns and sensitive skin because it forms an additional barrier, but it doesn't really have any lubricating properties.
Okay, so the squalene.
Squalene would be one. Sesame oil is pretty good if you want to go organic. That's relatively cheap, so that's one that you could buy in quantity and use all over your body. Put it on right after your bath or shower when your skin cells are moist and the pores are open.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I've been doing is I read somewhere to put olive oil in your hair before you shower for like about an hour and just let it soak into the scalp, and then after you wash it out, and it gives your hair more moisture, and I find that really helps.
Right,
keeps
right.
Keeps my hair from tangling, you know, it gets dry and then it tangles.
Yeah.
So that helps.
Good, that's good trick. Do you have any problems with your skin cracking or splitting? Is it that bad, or is it?
No.
Okay.
No, because I'm constantly moisturizing it. It probably would if I didn't.
Yeah.
Know?
Well,
no, I use things like organic, natural hand and body lotion.
Yeah, you know, the thing you could try just without doing the blood testing would be to just take some additional pancreatic lipase, like get yourself some pancreatic enzymes at the health food store and take 3 or 4 of them.
Take extra ones?
Take extra ones when you take your fish oil.
Well, I only take vegetable oils. I don't take any...
What do you do for omega-3?
I use flax oil. I use olive oil. I use hemp oil.
Okay.
I use borage oil.
All right. So you may want to get that blood testing after all. I think that you may have an imbalance in... You may actually have more omega-6 than you think you do.
Okay.
Because some people are poor...
So make sure I have the right level.
Right. Some people are poor metabolizers. They don't convert the flaxseed oil or the hemp oil into omega-3, the useful omega-3s.
Uh-huh.
It just sort of sits there. They can't really utilize it biologically. So that's a possibility. I think I'd get the blood test. The lab is Genova, G-E-N-O-V-A, and it's called Fatty Acid Analysis is the name of the test.
Fatty Acid Analysis.
Yeah, I think I would get that. It's probably going to cost you $100. It's not a super expensive test.
Okay, now what about something called hyaluronic acid? I've heard that that's a good thing for the skin, but it's difficult to absorb internally. Is that correct?
Well, you aren't going to absorb it internally as hyaluronic acid. You're going to digest it. It's basically protein and sugar. Your body is really good at breaking down protein and sugar, obviously. So you'll absorb it as components. And those components, theoretically at least, because they're just like Legos, you know, you've got the red Legos and the blue Legos right there. So you're going to put them back together and have more hyaluronic acid in the joints as a result of having more precursor in the bloodstream. That's never really been substantiated. It's a theoretical justification for taking it, but I'm not so sure that it really would stand up under actual physiological scrutiny. I haven't been super impressed with hyaluronic acid taken internally. We can inject it, and we do inject it into joints.
That's what I've read as well.
Works really well. You can inject it into wrinkles. There's Restylane and Juvederm are two FDA-approved products for filling in wrinkles. It stays put like caulk under the skin, and you can fill in wrinkles that way. Kind of interesting idea, but it works quite well, and it's soft. And you know.
How about the cream?
I have no idea. I think it would probably hold moisture in, act as a good barrier because of the way it cross-links. It should act like an umbrella and keep things from evaporating. Collagen will do that too when you put it on the surface of the skin. Any protein matrix will do that, but you still have to be making the moisture and the sebum from the inside to hold it against the skin for that to be very helpful. I think it's probably going to be expensive and overrated in your situation.
Yeah.
I think your issue may be production rather than preservation.
Rather than thinking externally, I should be thinking internally, which is why I'm calling.
Okay. So,
is that correct?
Yeah, get the amino acid testing because given what you're taking, I really think you should look at your ratios.
So,
get the fatty acid testing. I misspoke, not amino acid.
Anything else you think I should be looking for here?
Not off the top of my head. I'd have to know a whole lot more about you clinically, and that's really beyond our scope here on the program.
Yeah. All right.
Okay, good luck.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Oh, one last thing I meant to say. Don't bathe every day. Just, you know, hit the pits and the crotch and then maybe every 3 days immerse yourself in water. That is a really good way to retain skin moisture. You can clean your body with sesame oil. Just kind of put it all over and then kind of squeegee it off. And that will get dirt and skin oil replaced as well as removing dirt. And that's another strategy for people who have problems with dry skin for whatever reason. I want to take a moment and read a couple of emails I felt compelled to get right back to Larry in Mountain View about his back issues. I'm going to shorten Larry's email, which is fairly long. He's 53 and only about 10 pounds overweight and has developed really severe back pain when he stands for longer than 5 minutes. It's been going on for about 2 years, and he gets tingling and numbness in his foot. And if he continues, it starts to feel weak and he gets spasm in his gluteals. Standing is the worst for him, and if he sits, he does a lot better. Now, this is a classic presentation of spinal stenosis. Larry's been doing physical therapy, and he's been started on Neurontin at bedtime, and he saw a neurosurgeon who immediately told him he needed surgery, suggesting an anterior lumbar interbody fusion. What Larry had a year ago was an MRI that showed that at the L5-S1 level, he had grade 1 anterolisthesis of L5 on S1. In other words, he had some movement of the L5 disc on the S1 vertebrae. And he had degenerative disc disease and enlarged facet joints, which was pushing on the left opening for the nerve. I've translated that a little bit for you. So the neurologist basically said, well, you need surgery. You'll need it sooner or later. Call me when you're ready. So Larry's done some reading and isn't all that thrilled with ALIF surgery and wants to know what he can do. And he's only 53 years old, so he's got a long time ahead of him. The first thing I want you to do, Larry, is go look up the January 6th, 2010 issue of Journal of the American Medical Association. And you can go online and pay a fee for this. There's a commentary on page 71 of that issue called Diagnosis and Management of Lumbar Spinal Stenosis. And it's written by a doctor who does physical medicine and rehab. And what he points out is that there's really no basis for operating on people because they have an abnormal MRI. And he talks in this commentary about something that I think you should seek out. And it's called EMG paraspinal mapping. And what they do in EMG is they measure the muscle impulses. So they check the health of the nerve by putting an electrode near the nerve, stimulating the nerve, and then measuring the muscle response at a distance. This tells you how good the cabling is. It's a continuity test. And if the nerve is being damaged, then the continuity testing will show you that. So your pain and your numbness might not be, strictly speaking, due to the spinal stenosis. And before you go and have surgery, you should make sure that there's a good chance the surgery is going to help you. Another point Dr. Haig makes in this article is that everyone with spinal stenosis and pain should have conservative therapy first. And conservative therapy is not just physical therapy. It's going in there and injecting cortisone in the irritated nerve root and in the facet to see how much of your pain can be reversed. Use of a scooter when you go to gallery shows would be something to consider as well. And very important preconception, in most cases, spinal stenosis is a stable disorder. It's not going to rapidly deteriorate and cause a problem. And that's the story that people get from their surgeon is, well, if we don't operate on this now, you could have, in capitals with, you know, low organ in the background, permanent nerve damage. Well, yeah, maybe, but there's not a lot of scientific data or observational or epidemiologic data to support that contention. So before you get surgery, you should definitely try conservative management, and you should definitely please see if you can get that EMG mapping. So go look up the article. Walk into the doctor's office and wave it at him. It's Journal of the American Medical Association, for God's sakes. It's not, you know, alternative therapies. It's something that any self-respecting doctor has to be willing to look at. Also, just on the commentary on the ALIF surgery, it says that it shouldn't be done for people with significant instability. And I'm wondering how stable your spine is, or whether this is something that this particular type of fusion might not be the right surgery. This is actually an old surgery, not a new surgery. And I'm wondering if it just happens to be that particular neurosurgeon's favorite procedure rather than the best procedure for you. Anyway, time for some second opinions. We're going now to Michael in Corralitos. Hello, Michael. Welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Good morning,
Dr. Don, and thank you for your service to the community.
Well, thank you.
I'm taking care of a dear friend who has pneumonia. She was coughing for a number of days and then had high fevers for 3 days. And after a while, I went, it's time to see a doctor. The doctor prescribed amoxicillin and buterol breather. But right. The big question is, we're taking a cough medicine with the codeine to stop the coughing at night. It just doesn't seem to have any effect in terms of stopping the coughing. Which
I know the coughing can be terrible, and it really, you know, keeps you awake, and that interferes with the healing.
Keeps everybody else awake.
Well, yes, I know. But, you know, my attitude there is, she's the sick person, go get earplugs, you know, deal. But you want to be careful about over-suppressing cough, because you want to be able to clear the phlegm. If the cough isn't very productive anymore, or what she's coughing up is now very pale white color, then you can try suppressing the cough further. Codeine works by inhibiting the cough reflex. There's another agent called Tussinex, which has a different mechanism. Tessalon, T-E-S-S-A-L-O-N. It's a prescription. They look like little vitamin E capsules, and they suppress cough as well. If, like I said, if the phlegm is not really ugly looking at this point, it would be okay to use it, because the phlegm's improvement means that your antibiotic is working. I'm also wondering if the antibiotic is actually amoxicillin with clavulanic acid, which is to say generic Augmentin, rather than just amoxicillin.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, okay, good. How old is your friend?
She's 59.
59. Does she smoke? Cigarettes or marijuana? Either
intermittently.
One. Okay. So she may have triggered some sort of incipient chronic bronchitis and might benefit from the use of an inhaled steroid for a few weeks. So another thing you might want to do is go back and get some fluticasone or some Beclavent, which is a cheaper generic version of an inhaled steroid. You're trying to reduce the inflammation, because smokers, even sometimes smokers, tend to drop into a chronic bronchitis after they get pneumonia, and they'll cough for a long time. The other possibility, and given that we're in the middle of a pertussis epidemic, I do have to mention it, is that she may actually have pertussis, which is whooping cough, and that will give you a pneumonia-like syndrome, but you'll cough for 2 months. And it does respond to inhalers and inhaled steroids. So I think I would go back to the doctor and try an inhaled steroid and the Tessalon and see if those work better than the codeine cough syrup.
And just for sort of a general education, could you talk more about the mechanism of pneumonia and how it's contracted?
And
the stages that one goes through.
Well, talking about pneumonia is kind of like talking about cancer, in that there are lots of different pneumonias, different bacteria, and depending on which bacteria, you have, you know, really different manifestations. For example, staphylococcal pneumonia, that's the staph that causes boils or abscesses. If you get that in your lungs, it's usually after a bout of influenza, and you get a secondary bacterial pneumonia. And that bacterial pneumonia forms boils and abscesses in your lungs and literally rots pieces of your lungs. And it's about 50% fatal. So that's like totally nasty pneumonia. There's another one called pneumococcal pneumonia, which is Streptococcus pneumoniae. That's the one that killed Jim Henson, the Muppeteer. He got it and he was dead within like 48 hours, and he's like super rich guy at the time, so it wasn't like he didn't have access to medical care. But that one will get into the bloodstream and cause sepsis, and then you go into shock, and your survival rate on that's about 50% as an adult if you go into septic shock. So some pneumonias are just horrible, fulminant nastiness. And then the next person who lives with the person will get a sore throat or a little bronchitis from it. So there's a lot of variation in terms of the host response that determines how sick you get. So that's one of the other things that makes it not just like talking about pneumonia. But classically, it's an infection where the bacteria get down into the little air sacs and the alveoli, and you get pus in your air sacs. You're supposed to have air in your air sacs, and if you have pus in your air sacs, that takes those guys offline for transferring oxygen. So people with pneumonia don't have full use of their lungs, and they can't get as much oxygen into their bloodstream. And you can get by on about a quarter of a lung if you're just lying there in bed breathing, but you're not going to have...
That's the lethargy that happens.
Bingo. If you try to get up and walk across the room, you're out of breath because you're working on half of a lung or something like that instead of two full lungs. So that's part of it. There are all sorts of complications I can't get into here. And then there are the atypical pneumonias, which are non-pus forming and tend to cause more spasm and more asthma-like syndrome. And then there's whooping cough, which is not, strictly speaking, a pneumonia, but a itis of the respiratory passageways. And then you have the viral pneumonias, which are also tend to be more itises of the respiratory passageways. So lots of coughing and malaise, but not much pus in the air sac. So not as much shortness of breath, but a lot more coughing. Tends to be a dry cough. So there you have it, the quick riff on pneumonia.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Have a great day.
All right. Bye-bye.
We'll go now to John in Salinas. Hello, John in Salinas.
Yeah, quickly, I have a friend with severe back pain. Matter of fact, she just went out on disability this past week. And with her, the scenario she's had for some time, but is that she really is a computer worker, if you will. 100% of her time is really sitting at a computer. So even though she's got not overweight, she really doesn't get any physical exercise. And now with the pain, she's gone through the physical therapy, but she's supposed to be exercising to strengthen the musculature, and yet she's in too much pain to do that. And of course, at this point, the insurance kicks her off physical therapy, so her only real the insurance would pay for a surgery, but they won't pay for
anything
in between the two.
Isn't that fun? Okay. So,
the question I had was, I know that there are trusses. I know Tiger Woods famously used it one for months on a golf course, and I'm wondering why that isn't sometimes considered a solution, or at least a way to deal with some of the symptoms of the pain.
You mean lumbar support?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think it absolutely is used, and it's used quite a bit for people. It's typically the people that would be using it would be rehab doctors, physiatrists, and if you go to a orthopedic surgeon or a neurosurgeon, of course, what they do is back surgery. So you may not be getting to the right doctor. A lot of that's directed by the insurance companies who are... Let's just say they have a set of perverse incentives that aren't necessarily oriented towards the best interest of the patient, and leave that at...
Be purely coincidental if it was, I guess.
Leave that... Well, the way we've set the system up, it's backwards. But in the case of your friend, I have some specific suggestions. One of which is she needs to get one of these timers that turns off her computer screen every 15 minutes or 20 minutes and make her get up and walk around. Because, you know, you dive down the rabbit hole and you are absolutely not going to come up for air when you need to. So she needs to get up and move around. Ideally, she should have a secondary computer at her office that's a laptop that's at a chest height so that she can stand and work. I have this couple of patients with chronic low back pain, and it's just cured them. It's as simple as that. Just getting up and working half their day standing up and half their day sitting down has made an enormous improvement in their back pain.
Is there anything negative right now where she's in pain and on disability and sitting at home to using some sort of a back support to get, you know, back to work, if you will?
Well, my concern is if she's that much of a couch potato, and I'm not trying to call names
well,
or anything, but if she's become kind of if she's become kind of a couch sprout and she puts on a brace, she's going to weaken her muscles further.
Okay.
So the lecture I give people when I give them a lumbar support is the price of wearing this is you know, 15 minutes of sit-up and back extensions, and you take your pain pill and you get down on the floor and you do your exercises, and you've got to commit to that, because otherwise this will make you worse. And I give them that little speech. Hopefully 50% of them actually hear it and do what I've asked them to do. Some other suggestions for your friend. It's summer. There are swimming pools. Get a water skiing vest and go out and put the water skiing vest on. That'll keep you upright. And jog out to the deep end. Get out there above, you know, off of your feet, basically floating in the vest, and do jogging, do running in place, do leg extensions, you know, do leg lifts.
Yeah, that was one of the things she was looking for, but you couldn't find any pool nearby. We're out in the county, Monterey County, and there's nothing around, so it's painful for her to drive to get to a pool. So
maybe she can do some kind of trade and get somebody to drive her, but
yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
she's got to move.
Yeah,
and if
no,
that means, you know, take pain meds so you can get up and move, then it means take pain meds. She should also look into acupuncture. And yes, it costs money, but being disabled for the rest of your life isn't exactly cheap in terms of what that's going to cost you in the long run of missed income.
It's just a different way to short circuit the nerve pathways. So.
Yeah, exactly. And okay, a lot of times you get into a pain loop where your nerves have just gotten locked into pain transmission, and you actually get augmented pain. So if she's getting into the situation where just light stroking across the lower back is hurting her, then she's in a pain loop. She's upregulated, and acupuncture will help downregulate that.
So would ice do the same thing? I mean, like cold compress?
No, not really. Ice is good for acute injury. It might numb her up enough that she could get up and move around, but it's also going to tighten the muscles, and so it'll be kind of counterproductive.
Yeah,
she could try heat, a lot of warm compresses, warm baths. She needs to move.
Yeah.
You know, she really does.
Okay, that's very helpful.
I hope so. Thank you.
Sure.
Bye-bye. One last email. This one from Lydia in Whitmore, California, who is wanting to tell us about some anecdotal information. I found this very interesting. A friend recommended I try St. John's wort oil for numbness around my hip surgery site from 2006, and it seemed to help, and the numbness disappeared. I recently used it on a friend's feet. He had chemotherapy for tongue and throat cancer in 2008 and lost feeling in about two-thirds of the left foot. That was due to his chemotherapy, folks. He says the half-hour oiling and massaging the feet does not cure the condition, but temporarily returns feeling to the upper parts of the feet. He really liked the St. John's wort oil. So I thought I'd throw that out because we had a neuropathy call from Jane in Florida, or I should say an email, about neuralgia. After 15 years of marriage to my husband at age 55, I've contracted genital herpes from him. I understood that this was a possibility when we met, so I can deal with it emotionally. The relationship is good and he tries to be supportive, but I have also developed herpetic neuralgia, which is driving me nuts. It's been about a year now, and I've only seen a very small improvement. Thank heavens for the gabapentin, or I would definitely be insane from the pain. I take 300 milligrams of gabapentin AM and PM. I also take daily valacyclovir, which is, parenthetically, folks, an anti-herpes drug. I have intense pain on attempting intercourse and have to be very warmed up until the pain becomes manageable so we can be intimate. A few questions. Do you think I can safely take these two medications long-term? Would estrogen help with the pain? And although I'm 5 years postmenopausal, I never had a problem with dryness until this neuralgia. Help. First of all, to answer your questions, Jane, I do think that you can take both of these drugs long-term. That's been done by literally millions of people without obvious adverse side effects. Nothing's cropped up there. And so I do think long-term use is safe, and I would encourage that. I do want to point out that herpetic neuralgia from genital herpes is actually quite rare. And I hope that you've gotten this diagnosis from a neurologist. And if not, I think you should see a neurologist or a gynecologic neurologist if there's some such animal in your area. If the diagnosis is confirmed, I would certainly suggest you try acupuncture for this. This is an odd thing. Something's gone really wrong with the nerve settings. And that is a way of rebooting, if you will, the nerve computer. And it's definitely worth a try because it is really rare. And I would also say, estrogen, yes, estrogen suppositories, estrogen creams for at least a month daily. Really try to get that mucosa back to premenopausal estrogen levels because some of this may, in fact, just be vaginal atrophy showing up because you stopped having sex because you had the herpes. The thing after menopause is it's a use it or lose it proposition. So I've had plenty of women who were having a happy sex life until the age of 60 when something happened and they didn't have sex for 6 months. And when they tried to go back and have sex again, they couldn't because the tissues had just gone atrophic on them. If they don't receive constant stimulation postmenopausally, they definitely will start to give you atrophy. So hopefully with that advice, you'll be able to feel better. And I'm very sorry for your situation and hope you feel better soon. Well, we've come to the end of another hour, and I hope you've enjoyed the program as much as I have. Thanks to all of the people who emailed. Thanks to all of the callers. Thanks to my producer and webmaster, Charles Mansky. And thanks to everyone here at KUSP for holding this lovely little place together. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.